Well, you heard it here, folks. Owls are assholes.
Welcome to another episode of Smells Like Identity Hygiene, the podcast where we dive deep into the nuances of cybersecurity and the crucial importance of maintaining clean and secure digital environments. Today's session is called Meet Locals in Your Server, How Local Accounts Can Cause Devastating Security Issues. In this episode, we're unpacking a critical yet often overlooked aspect of cybersecurity, local accounts on servers, databases, and applications. While they may seem harmless tucked away in the corners of your IT infrastructure, these local accounts can actually pose a ticking time bomb of risk, threatening the very integrity of an organization. Join us as we explore why these accounts are frequently ignored and the potential dangers they present, providing insights and strategies to mitigate these hidden threats effectively. Let's get started. I'm your host, Katie, and I'm here with my co-host, Rosie. We are pleased to welcome our special guest, Adam Markert, Solutions Architect at CyberArk.
What exactly is a local account on a server?
So generally speaking, the term local account can have kind of a broad definition in that it's really just not part of a greater directory service or an external identity provider, but it is local to the application, the operating system, or the infrastructure component that it's found on.
And Adam, I know that your background before you were at CyberArk, you were actually a CyberArk customer. You were someone that actually used the product, were doing this infrastructure, the security work. So why do you think we still have local accounts, right? Directory services have been around forever. If you're old enough, you'll remember Novell and obviously then Active Directory. Now you have things like Okta and Entra ID or Active Directory, Azure AD. Why do you think we still have this problem?
I think there's always a built-in account that is used to bootstrap the configuration of that system. So it's hard to join a Windows domain if you can't log into the server to begin with. It's hard to configure directory-based authentication to a database without having the native database credential. In many cases, those accounts remain in use because they don't want the dependency on an external directory or authentication system. And so they're often used for break glass. They're often used for the initial config. They're often used as an integration account, for example, that may not be in the directory, but is used by an external system to get access to that target. So there's a lot of reasons to still have them. And there's a lot of examples of them, but I don't see us getting away from them anytime soon, especially since it seemed like for a long time, if you're old enough, and I think, Rosie, you and I are, it seemed like eventually everything was going to go into Active Directory integration. But the world that we live in today is it's a little bit more varied. AD is still a huge player, especially in the enterprise. But a lot of new companies that start up never deploy Active Directory. They use a cloud-based directory of some kind. They're primarily doing SaaS-based identity providers. And so it's not clear if you were to get rid of local accounts entirely, what exactly you would default to as the external source of identities. So to me, it just seems less likely today that we're ever going to get rid of these things than it was in the past.
What about other platforms like databases and applications? Local accounts can exist there too. So is that also an issue for customers?
It is for many reasons, because usually the first built-in account is also basically a God mode account. If you think about your Windows local administrator or the database account, if you're dealing with SQL Server, for example, you have that SA account that has full access to everything in that database. Those are often targets from attackers, and they're often able to really cause a lot of damage. And if we look at the database example, complete data exfiltration, denial of service to other systems that legitimately should have access to the database, the creation of backdoor accounts that can be used to fly under the radar, because you don't want to stay running as SA for too long, because that might ring some bells, but you could create other more least privileged accounts that can still basically read data. So there's a lot of risk inherent in unmanaged, unmitigated control of local accounts. Your cloud platforms all will natively have some kind of built-in account types. Like in AWS, you'll have IAM users or access keys for those users. So it really extends beyond traditional infrastructure all the way to the cloud.
What you're describing is that local accounts are a bad thing, right? Or they can be used for bad actors to do bad things. So should organizations actively be trying to get rid of local accounts?
It's unrealistic to expect that we can fully get rid of them, especially those built-in accounts. I think getting rid of them or disabling them in some way creates a lot of availability problems, but it is a part of the attack surface that we have to pay attention to and reduce the risk of. I suspect you're going to ask how we might do that, and we can talk about that in some kind of broad strokes, but I think a good place to start is having a complete inventory of those. If you don't know about it, you can't manage it. So we need to make sure that we have a good picture of where all the built-in accounts are, whether that's operating systems, databases, cloud platforms, network security appliances, anything that's got a local account. Discovery is step number one. And then having good privileged access management controls, especially for the highly privileged built-in accounts, becomes critical. So after we discover, we often talk about having some kind of credential vaulting, some automated rotation, and then other privileged access controls to manage access to the target system if anyone ever needs that. If there are other things that we can do on the detection side, for example, if we take that database example, we might want to know if anybody's using the SA account. It should be a fairly rare thing after a database is deployed because you're likely using other least privileged accounts or admin credentials to access that database on an ongoing basis. And the SA is really just reserved for those break glass scenarios. So you may want to alert on the usage of those built-in accounts, especially if you know that you've put in processes that should minimize their use. So I think it's unrealistic to expect us to get rid of them entirely. I think it would be unwise in many scenarios to do that because it could create denial of service. And instead, I think it's more realistic and more operational or operationally efficient to just manage those risks in an efficient, repeatable way.
Local accounts can't just be eradicated as much as we think it would probably be helpful if an organization was to come to you and ask how they could properly protect those accounts. How would you suggest that they get started? How would you suggest that they approach it in general?
For sure. There's really two big recommendations. So one is there's the sense that there is a set of privileged accounts that we really can't get rid of. Doing some kind of discovery-based scan, you can do that with privileged access tools like with CyberArk, but you can also do it with good configuration management tools and vulnerability scanners and other tools can often give you some insight into where those accounts live. And then you can decide based on the risk of that particular system, the level of access the account has, and other factors, what controls are appropriate to reduce the risk of that account. So that's a whole practice on its own. The other side is often we can get away with reducing the number of privileged accounts. Again, we may have to leave the built-in accounts in play, but if there are other accounts that people use for day-to-day access, or if there are cases where we create local accounts for specific use cases or services or something, many times we can get away with using something like a just-in-time type of access. So instead of having a local account sitting there all the time and having it need to be discovered and vaulted and rotated, another approach is to really put in controls that can dynamically create an account, allow somebody to use it to perform a specific task, and then that account goes away after that session's over. Creates a little bit more visibility, right? Versus somebody just using a full-time credential, but also it just reduces the number of accounts that we need to manage with those sort of traditional controls. And it makes your audit reports a little bit nicer because there's just fewer privileged accounts out there at any specific point in time. Then just defining good policies around who can get that kind of access and what conditions we want to place around that, what their authentication expectations would be, what machines they could get access to, what groups and roles they need to be in before they would qualify for just-in-time access. That then becomes the concern about who has access to those systems with local account privileges instead of just who has access to the password for this machine. It changes the conversation to using more kind of attribute-based access control methods versus just possession of a credential as the main control method.
So we know that, of course, CyberArk was built to solve problems like this with not just local accounts, but domain accounts and any account in your environment. Can you talk a little bit about specifically how CyberArk solves this problem with the traditional CyberArk PAM solution? And some of the newer things that are available in CyberArk to solve some of the other problems you talked about, where it's SaaS accounts or authentication to those other applications that may not necessarily live on-prem at a customer.
For sure, yeah. So if we describe how we do these things at a high level, and these controls, by the way, will apply whether we're talking about customers of our self-hosted solution or whether we're talking about our privileged cloud customers that opt for SaaS. These are foundational controls that work largely the same in either solution. But step one is often to either start with an existing inventory of accounts, and we can perform a bulk upload of them into the right vault or set of safes, which we can think of as just containers into which we put privileged accounts. Those containers will have access control lists on them that will define who's able to access them after they're imported into the system. And of course, those users, right? I won't use the term local, but they can be members of the CyberArk Cloud directory, for example, or they can be members of an integrated directory like AD or Entra ID or an external identity provider. So they'll kind of govern access to the accounts after they're imported. The other primary way to get things in is to do a discovery scan. So we can discover credentials already as a built-in scan engine into the system that will identify things like your Windows and Linux, like local accounts. We're adding additional target system support for discovery in the future. We've got a whole roadmap for enhancing our discovery capabilities. And so that's one way, of course, to integrate. And then, of course, there are partners like you that provide additional solutions, which give us more visibility and discovery into things like databases and stuff. So again, if we can leverage those tools to enrich the built-in capabilities, awesome. I don't really care at the end of the day where the data comes from, so long as we get that visibility and that it gets onboarded appropriately into CyberArk. At that point, though, it's really up to us to define what we want the policies to be about how frequently we rotate those credentials and what workflows we may want to put into access of them. So maybe we want things like dual control or a ticketing integration before we grant access to credentials. Again, those decisions are pretty granularly assigned, but they depend a lot on the risk of the credential, the risk of the user, the type of system that we're accessing, the potential for data loss or other kind of business interruption. So all those things can be weighed, and we can apply various controls to prevent the inappropriate disclosure of a credential or the inappropriate usage of a credential in a privileged session. And then the other big piece is once we've got those accounts on the system and people are using them, we want to just monitor exactly what's going on with privileged accounts. We want to make sure that people aren't doing nefarious things, that they aren't creating backdoor accounts or performing other operations on systems that they shouldn't be. And so part of that is monitoring what happens in a privileged session. The other part is using least privilege controls to make sure that we don't allow certain activities that are inappropriate for the specific use case that we're considering. So those are the core controls, how we typically handle privileged access, and they apply to really any system as well. So if we're talking about domain accounts, if we're talking about cloud-based accounts or SaaS-based accounts, the controls are largely similar, right? When we look at the different attack patterns that can happen, we'll see technical differences in how you might gain access to a credential. If we're thinking about local Windows credentials, we know that there's a specific set of attacks there related to LSAS harvesting or getting access to SAM account hashes and things like that. Those techniques aren't going to apply to my Salesforce login, but the Salesforce login is going to have a similar set of attacks that are relevant to it, like stealing credentials from my browser or stealing or doing post-authentication attacks, like stealing cookies or authentication tokens after I've already used my credential. So bypassing MFA and credential knowledge entirely. The attack patterns, right, are largely the same. The techniques are slightly different, right, because we're talking about different types of target systems, but we want to apply similar controls to interrupt the attack pattern, regardless of whether we're dealing with a local account or a SaaS account.
Yeah, there definitely is the misconception that once you do implement some kind of directory services solution, number one, I've heard customers say we want to get rid of all of our local accounts and convert everything to domain accounts. And of course, where possible, you should do that, have them centrally managed, obviously have them in a vaulting solution if you do have to have them. But as you said, you do have to have a number of accounts that have to live, whether it's application accounts or database or local operating system accounts. The question is, what are you doing to protect those accounts? Are they properly vaulted? Are you password rotating them? Are they in a managed solution, which just strengthens why you still need a PAM solution, right? That some directory services solution that is handling the authentication piece can't necessarily also handle the way that you have to properly protect a privileged account. Would you say that you have to treat all local accounts as privileged?
I wouldn't say that. There is an argument, of course, that any account can be privileged given the right circumstances and conditions. I tend not to speak in absolutes too much. To me, often the most powerful accounts in a system are local in nature. A, because they're either built in and they have full rights on that target system, but B, because they can also lead to lateral movement to other systems, and they can lead to the compromise of broader credentials too. As a simple example, if I have a Windows environment and I image all my machines the same and I've got the same local admin credential on every single one of them, if I compromise one, I've got them all. I can often then use that same credential to move laterally to other systems. With local admin rights, I can pull off a lot of different attack patterns then, and I can look for cached domain credentials. If it's a particularly sloppy environment, I may be likely to find a domain admin, for example, and then I can execute a complete takeover. I can execute the golden ticket attack. I can then basically masquerade as any user on the domain. So it isn't just the rights of that individual account that matter. It's how it can lead to successful reconnaissance, to the lateral movement risk, and to the privilege escalation. There's this whole pattern that will play out. That said, back to the original question, though, I think it is wise to consider any local account to be privileged because there's a potential there, right? There's always a potential for any account, especially one that exists persistently, to be used to elevate to the next most powerful account and then potentially escalate from there. I think it's wise then to reduce the number to the extent that we can, to adopt things like just-in-time so we have fewer of those accounts, and then to apply those privileged access controls to the ones that we can't eliminate.
There's a million ways that you could decide to resolve these or work towards them, but who's responsible for coming up with that strategy and who's responsible for actually executing on it?
The way that I like to triage these things is if we've done decent discovery, I imagine there's this matrix where we have kind of ease of mitigation as one axis and then another axis of the impact of that particular account. And so there's a sweet spot where there's fairly easy to mitigate and a high level of risk reduced from doing it. Those are obviously the things that we do first. And then we can move to the other quadrants in that matrix as things are still high risk, but harder. Maybe we work on those next. Maybe there's some easier stuff that's a little bit lower impact, but still reduces some risk. When it comes to things like service accounts, the big thing we need to worry about there is typically there's nothing magic about the account itself, but it's the dependencies that you have to worry about. So if we update this credential, great. Is the service going to begin to fail because it needs to consume the credential in some way? So if we're talking about a Windows service, that's fairly easy. We update the credential, we update the Windows service, optionally restart it. It's a fairly straightforward process. In other cases, an application might want to have the credential in its own database. It's built with an interface where the application owner goes in and they put the service account username and password, or they put in a certificate or something, and they're really responsible for updating it in the tool. In many cases, those can be a little bit tricky to update. Luckily, we have hundreds of integrations where the actual software provider has built our SDKs into their own product. So it can actually just pull the credential from CyberArk. So instead of putting a hard-coded credential into the app, it just queries CyberArk and says, give me my service account. And CyberArk says, okay, here's your username and your secret. Those sorts of things are very easy to implement as well. And so they often represent, again, a high level of risk reduction, fairly easy implementation. When you get down to some custom applications that are difficult to discover because they're not easily discovered by running a network scan or an inventory system, a lot of home root applications are like this. If you have customers, for example, that develop a lot of software in-house or rely on some really far out of support esoteric software solutions, you will come across ones that are consuming privileged accounts or service account credentials, and nobody really knows what the process is to update those. Those are the ones that are going to take a little bit more discovery work to do. So often it comes down to doing some interviews. And again, this can be security, this can be IAM, this can be other folks on kind of the infrastructure side, but we'll need to do a little bit more discovery work on that application. see if there's a known process or a supported process from the vendor for updating the credential, see if we've got integration possibilities with something like CyberArk. And if not, then we can work on doing some customizations to get it possible to auto-update those types of credentials. But it's really all down to that dependency management when it comes to service accounts. The other big thing to talk about with service accounts is just the big risk with them is the interactive usage of service accounts. Because in many cases, people will default to using those service accounts, which were set up with a specific purpose in mind, most often a non-human intention. It can sometimes be a little bit of a culture change, right? Because folks might be used to using that account all the time. But I think with some education, it becomes really clear how dangerous that can be. And that can help you justify making some changes to people's workflow. We're in an era where setting up automation is easier than it ever has been in a lot of respects, to the extent that people can help automate the stuff that would have taken. If I look back 10 years ago to when I was doing PAM administration, I did a lot more manually than I would ever do now. It just because we have either built-in functions that do that stuff automatically, or we have just more robust APIs that allow for a lot of automation of tasks, or we have other integrations that offload some of the work. And now we have ChatGPT and generative AI and stuff that has all kinds of applications in identity and access management and PAM specifically. So I think there's never been an easier time for smaller orgs to do this. It just comes down to having a good plan, having good support, kind of meeting that minimum separation of duties threshold. But otherwise, I don't see really any barrier to getting this risk reduction. I think it's harder and it's more dangerous to not do it at this point.
At Sphere, we talk about the importance of ownership when it comes to bridging the gap between discovery and actually remediation, right? And to some extent, ownership and the challenges with ownership is one of the reasons why a small team has a hard time tackling some of these issues, right? Of figuring out, I can't just arbitrarily make the decisions onboard this local account, the service account, and turn on password reconciliation, onboard it properly so that we are protecting it properly.
I think it's really important from an accountability perspective to have things like ownership tagging on service accounts and privileged accounts. In many cases, in the privileged access management world, we deal with something like a personal privileged account, in which case the owner is very obvious. It's the individual that uses it, and usually they're the sole individual that uses it. But when we talk about local accounts, shared administrator accounts, domain accounts that multiple people could have access to, all of those things are like, now we need to know who's responsible for this because there are so many functions that come along with it. They might be the person that needs to approve something like a dual control workflow. They might be the person that needs to recertify access to other people to that. It becomes this key control, right, to have some kind of ownership over that. And actually, that's one of the reasons why we have so many customers that like using Sphere, because you give that suggested like owner. Because when we do a discovery scan, we find the account, we know what system it's on, we know how old the password is, we know a lot of details about it, but we don't know who, in terms of what human being in the organization ought to be responsible for it or should do any of those other functions. You need some other data in order to do that. And so I think having the ability to assign that owner is great. We can certainly do that. We can add a field in there for owner, right? It's not a problem. But populating it is a little bit trickier. And when I did it in the past, didn't have Sphere Board. So it was tracking down individuals that are like, oh, I know it's this server, so I'll start with the server team, and then they'll point to an app owner. And you just kind of, it's a bit of a slog to do that. So anything that one can do to help narrow down the field of who owns something and give a suggested or tentative owner that is a much better place to start, I think is hugely valuable. And again, for anybody that's operating with a smaller team and is looking for certain tasks in the program to automate, that would be huge on my list for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting how again, I'm dating myself, but I remember a time where, some of the earliest jobs I had where we used to have shared terminals. Someone could walk up
Sure.
to a laptop or a desktop that was on the counter, and the credentials were written on a note, a sticky note right there, and anyone could walk up, log in, because the idea is that no one can get onto the floor of the building. So it's only employees who can log in. And this is an application that needs to be shared by everyone, but we can't install it on all the machines. And that concept of shared accounts obviously had to go away, and that went away But it feels like it's now been replaced with the idea of service accounts, especially as you said, service accounts with interactive logons effectively become shared accounts. So it becomes even more critical to ensure that if you do have to have that situation where a service account has to exist and multiple people have to have access to it, that you need to properly protect that account, that it needs to be in a vault where you know who's checking out those credentials, and you can restrict exactly who has access. And if that person leaves the firm, you don't worry about them walking out of the organization with that, with those credentials.
Anyone that has dealt with trying to track down what human being was using a shared account, if you look at the logon activity or SIM logs, right, all you're going to see in many cases is just that shared account name. And if it's like the kind of classic kiosk situation, like you mentioned, where it's just logged in as a generic user all the time, you've lost all of the attribution to individual user activity. So the only way to really counter that is to obviously enforce correct, proper, ideally frictionless or passwordless logins for those endpoints. Or if it has to be a shared account or a shared service account with interactive logon, that we do things like session management and activity logging so that we can establish that full trail back to the individual user. We'll strongly authenticate the human. If they're using a shared service account, we have that activity logged. And we can guarantee that we know who is using a particular account at a certain point in time. So, multiple ways to get there. But for anything that's shared usage like that, we have to have those controls in place. The sort of corporate social media account often never gets created under any kind of governance structure or with any kind of visibility. So, it's often not even really known about until that kind of disgruntled employee thing happens, or phishing or other attacks to that credential. It doesn't have to be a motivated insider scenario, but it can just be the fact that there was password reuse or a successful phishing attack that resulted in that loss of control. So there needs to be a little bit of organizational rigor and control around the sign up and creation of those accounts. And to the extent that we can enforce multi-factor for those platforms is really huge to prevent some of the attacks that have been successful. There's a few notable ones that involve just brute force or single credential theft, like a password. And a lot of those can be prevented just by taking advantage of the native multi-factor that most of the social media platforms have, like for sure, Facebook and Google and others have that at this point. So that's important to implement. At least they do support FIDO keys. Because I think I use one of those. I have a YubiKey for my personal Facebook account. So give them some credit for that. That's huge.
If
Yeah.
support would answer the requests that I've put in, call support, then I could give them a shout out for that in the background. Okay, so
Come on, Zuck, come through for us.
right, he and his total transformation going from basement nerd to now he looks like young gravy. I don't know if you guys have seen the transformation of Zuckerberg from his original form to now he's evolved into his second form of Pokemon.
Just like Jeff Bezos.
CyberArk Impact is this month, and then there's a series of other events throughout the year. What can people who are attending expect? You know, why it's important for your customers to attend?
There's a ton of great stuff if you're a customer. So, a lot of training opportunities, of course. So, if there's any area of the CyberArk solution or platform that you want to get specific in-depth training on, there's tons of courses that you can sign up for. And the other big thing is just being present for all of the different product announcements. Usually there's stuff announced that I haven't heard about yet. And we all find out from our product management teams at the same time that a lot of our customers do. And it's really exciting for kind of everybody that's in the room there. So a lot of kind of new product announcements. The keynote speakers are great. And those training opportunities, I think it becomes a really interesting few days. We'll find out, I'm sure, last minute what the evening event is for that. That's usually kept secret, but there's always some good music event, for example, that and it I'm assuming it's got to be of that nature. If we're going to Nashville, we can probably put a link in somewhere in the description, right? Link in the description for CyberArk Impact if you haven't already signed up.
We've reached the portion of our session where we do our non-serious, non-cybersecurity related question. If all animals could talk, which would be the rudest, or, and I can bleep this out if needed to, but basically the biggest asshole?
Owls. Just look at their faces. They are angry all the time.
Have you ever seen an owl run? How could they be threatening?
I actually don't think that this is my idea. This is like buried deep in the subconscious. If you Google owls are assholes, you will find an Onion article from 1997. And that must be how long that little fact has been rolling around in my head. But anyway,
Okay,
the
well.
picture of the owl, he just looks angry. And I suspect that since he spends his day killing rabbits and chipmunks and other cute animals that definitely would not be assholes, this is likely the correct answer.
But he looks like an old man that's, had a long life and is sick of the kids and, like, get off my lawn kind of face.
What would be
Yeah,
your
that makes
candidate,
sense.
Rosie?
I always thought kangaroos would be rude.
And they're quite violent and territorial. And they're
Yeah.
jacked too. Like they're a
Unhinged and
lean. Yeah.
scary.
If we weigh on the definition of asshole, like aggression as a heavier component, there are some terrifying creatures out there. I was just going to see if Caitlin had another contender for this that was rattling around.
The asshole, it's goats.
Goats?
Every time. Goats are dicks. Goats are just straight up mean. They're mean when they can't talk, and they just have no, it's
Yeah.
like maybe fainting goats because you could scream at them so they would shut up would
It,
be like an
they do butt
exception.
heads a lot. And it seems like when I was a child, I tried to feed one like in a petting zoo kind of scenario and it bit me. I don't think intentionally. It was so callous and indifferent to my suffering that I think it
True mark of
qualifies.
an asshole.
Yeah, just like and I'm sure I was crying and it didn't show a shred of empathy or regret or anything. It's almost sociopathic.
I think
Yeah.
you've convinced me. Owls are assholes.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Owls are
Goats.
assholes.
Thanks for tuning in to today's discussion on Smells Like Identity Hygiene. We're thrilled to announce that Sphere is a proud sponsor of CyberArk Impact 2024, kicking off in Nashville, Tennessee from May 20th to 22nd. We strongly encourage all CyberArk customers to join us there. It's an excellent opportunity to connect and dive deeper into the world of cybersecurity. As always, we're excited to offer more opportunities to explore today's topic. Join us for a live webinar on May 23rd at 2 p.m. Eastern, where we'll dive deeper into the issues surrounding local accounts and how to effectively manage these hidden threats. Looking ahead to next month, our episode comes live to you from Sphere's 360 Summit in Nashville, Tennessee. The session, titled Directory Declutter: The Minimalist Guide to Group Management, will explore the risks associated with nested groups, standing access, and undermanaged AD groups, and how to effectively gain and maintain control of group structures. If you're a current cybersecurity professional at the manager level or above for an enterprise, register for our 360 Summit at the link in the description. Enjoy exclusive access to industry experts like Maureen Allison from Johnson & Johnson and Keith Anderson from JetBlue. Plus, those attending the summit will be the first to hear about our new Sphereboard releases that will revolutionize Active Directory management and identity hygiene. That's all for now. Stay secure, and we look forward to seeing you in Nashville.